You're listening to An Englishman in the Balkans.
Welcome to An Englishman in the Balkans, the podcast that takes you on a captivating journey into the heart of Bosnia and Herzegovina and the wider Western Balkans. Each episode, we delve into the rich history, vibrant culture, and hidden gems of this beautiful country. Through engaging conversations and personal anecdotes, we aim to bridge the gap between the Balkans and the rest of the world. So sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired, entertained, and connected.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe giving us a tip or becoming a member of our podcast family. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for listening. We really do appreciate it.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of An Englishman in the Balkans. In this episode, we're talking about what it's like to leave a country when you don't really want to do it. Normally, when we leave a country to go on holiday or we go to move to live somewhere else, it's planned. We know what we're doing and we know what the end is, the end result will be for us. But just think about if you have to leave your country, you're being forced out of your country and you have no control over it. In the 1990s, there was a conflict in the former Yugoslavia. There were conflicts between Serbia and Croatia, some small conflicts in what is now North Macedonia, and a big one here in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And in this episode, we're focusing on what it's like to leave when a country is in conflict, when you are forced out and you have to go through a very painful journey to get to somewhere which is really safe for you. Ivana Sterbac Alfonso was only 5 to 6 years old, living in a village outside a moderately large town in middle Bosnia called Zenica. And in this episode, I'm joined by Ivana, and I'll tell you where she ended up because we need to talk about that now. She ended up finally living in Australia on the Gold Coast. It's quite an emotional journey, and Ivana's been very gracious to join us for this episode to talk through what it's like to be a refugee and what it's like to rebuild a life. Who is Ivana Sterbac Alfonso? There's no better person in the world to tell us than Ivana herself. So who is Ivana Sterbac Alfonso?
Oh, David, holy moly. That was... First of all, thank you for the lovely introduction. I'm pleased and humbled to be on your podcast. We all know Australia and Britain. There's a canniness there. There's a likeness, you know. The Brits and the Aussies love each other. You know, they have the same love for the Queen. I don't know if I share the same sentiment, but, you know, I was really pleased that I somehow found you on Apple Podcasts. I was actually looking for my own podcast, Balkan Sis, and I was looking for the link to share my stories, and you popped up somewhere there. So I thought, who's this guy? An Englishman in the Balkans. Well, that's cool. You know, it's not every day you see that. So that's how we actually connected. So thank you for having me on. It's really, really awesome. I'm truly humbled and grateful. And thank you for waking up so early. I know Bosnia time is not 6 a.m. I mean, you know, it is maybe for some of the oldies. My dida used to get up at like 6 a.m. and have his coffee and go do whatever he needed to do. But usually for the young ones, it's not. So, yeah, look, who is Ivana? That is such a loaded question. Because I think of the history and the background and everything that I've been through, that my family's been through, it's such a complex answer. I think, you know, I'm a bit of everything, to be honest. I feel like I would love to just give a, you know, 3-word sentence or just one answer, but it's truly impossible to do that. But I will say that I'm truly a lover, a community builder, you know, first and foremost a mum. You know, that's one of my greatest titles ever. And a family woman. I love my family so much, and they've gotten me through some really hard stuff. And pretty much everything falls second and third beyond that. We have a business here, you know, we're business owners. I run mentoring and coaching and, you know, within the Balkan community, and I love to give back to the community. So yeah, I do many different things, but all things that I guess feed me and feed my soul. And maybe I'm just being that person that I needed when I was little, you know, so maybe I'm just showing up for that little old me, you know, that didn't get to have all these wonderful opportunities. So I'm truly just really squeezing the crap out of that lemon called life. And we're just seeing where it takes me.
In the 1990s, as I said, the region here fell into what can only be politely called ultimate chaos. We'll be talking about that throughout the episode. But back before the former Yugoslavia actually broke up and tore itself apart, there you are as a young girl living in Zenica. So what do you still have as vivid memories for you of that time before the war, as a child in Zenica?
Oh, man. Okay. So to put it in context, so there is, like I say, Zenica because it's the most sort of obvious location. Yeah, it's tricky with Australians that don't really know where anything is in our area. But I'm actually from an area, it used to be called Dolac, a very, very long time ago, and then it changed its name to Stranjane. So Stranjane is actually about maybe 20 minutes away from Zenica, and it's a very little remote village. And the life I remember living, I like brings tears to my eyes now, right? It's like we didn't have a lot, but we had everything, if that makes sense. I remember we lived in a one multi-generational home. So it was, we were downstairs, to put it in context. It was me, my brother and my sister at the time. My little brother came after the war. My parents, so we're all shacked up in this one little bedroom, and my dad's sleeping on the couch because he snores, so that qualifies him to sleep on the couch. And also he was a shift worker in the Rudnik, which is the, God, I don't even know how to say that in English. God, I don't know if it's not a mine, you know, David. But so upstairs was my baba and my dido, my grandparents, and then I had a lot of uncles and I had a lot of aunties. So my dad is one of six, one of seven, one passed away. Next door to me was my auntie and my uncle and my two little naughty cousins who used to beat the shit out of me. And I just remember community. I just remember my great-grandmother drinking her coffee with the sugar cube, you know. And I just have such beautiful, fond memories. I remember the smell of Yorgovani, you know, in spring and summer, you know, the beautiful trees and the flowers. We used to make flower crowns, me and my sister, with the ljubicice, the little purple lilies. And yeah, it was just wonderful for me, wonderful for us. Obviously, I was a child experiencing it from a child's perspective, you know, so for the adults, maybe things were a bit different, you know, because they were caretaking, they were working and living very differently. But for us children, we were, yeah, just village kids. So, you know, I remember one minute we've got Mr. Piggy or Mrs. Piggy gets grown all year. And next thing you know, you hear this, like, you know, pig being, you know, sent to its rainbow heaven, and you know, next thing you know, you got poor crackling in a bowl, and you're like, well, you know, it's just how it was. It was very raw, very original, and just, yeah, unfiltered, I guess you could say. We were shielded in a way, or we were shielded with love, and we were given all the right ingredients, but we definitely weren't, you know, helicoptered or anything like that. It was basically like, work it out yourself, you know. We had a toilet outside. So in the middle of the night, if you needed to go to the toilet, it was so you're like this little child, and my sister would be like waking me up. I'm in a cot. Oh, can you come out and help me to the toilet? You know, it was like, so, you know, when you think of it like that now, you think, man, it's the wild, wild west, right? Compared to now where I'm living and how raising my son is just a complete contrast. But I'm trying to raise him with the same values that I was brought up with. So the values very heavily relied on, you know, the culture, the community, the religion, the people, the unity. It was just all about this oneness and a lot about love and just home-cooked meals and laughter and togetherness. And yeah, like I think we didn't have running water coming straight to our house for quite some time. So, you know, it was like living very, very raw, very rural. But it was progressing, I guess you could say. It was progressing because people kept together and families helped one another. And, you know, we had a lot of land, a lot of animals. So, you know, it wasn't just one person getting the hay. It was many people getting the hay, grandmother washing down by the river, like on one of those, you know, old school things. And all the time my dad reminds me, don't whinge about the washing, even after the baba didn't even have a washing machine. But yeah, it was just obviously we didn't have to do those things when we were kids. But now looking back, I think, wow, physically life would have looked very different. But emotionally for us, we felt very safe and very loved and very protected.
How old were you when the chaos hit the village or the chaos hit the area? How old was Ivana back then? And how did Ivana cope with what must have been the most massive trauma when it comes to being forced to leave where you felt the most safe and the most coziest, and also as a very young child?
Honestly, that experience, like, you know, makes me emotional, obviously. I try not to cry, but that experience, I think, changed life for us forever, because essentially you want every child to grow up with trust, you know, within in the world, in the systems, in the people they're dealing with. So my natural go-to reaction now, I'll tie it back to how old I was, my natural reaction to things now is mistrust, you know, especially to everything that's been happening in the last few years. It's that my go-to is you can't trust, right? Because if you tie it back to that experience, you know, they say the first 7 years are the most formative for a child's life. And this happened when I just turned six. So I had turned six in the February, and it was Mali, it was Christo, like the small Easter was in April or end of March, beginning of April. And that's when it started to really, you know, I remember planks on the windows. I remember being told to duck. I remember not, don't go outside. Like, I remember all of that. I just remember it just looking gray, just feeling different. You know, it was no longer this safe space. And I remember that morning vividly because I could just smell fresh bread. And it's funny how as a child, I think you go to the safest thing, which is sight and smell. And I remember my mum had to wake us up that morning for us to flee, for us to run away. And I just remember crying. I had this massive big blanket. It was this blue blanket. It was my comfort blanket, I guess you could say. And my mum was like trying to rip it because I was crying about this blanket. In the meantime, my baba is with us, and she's got my two cousins that live next door. Their mother was already in Germany, so a lot of people had already left. You know, like a lot of people didn't think it was going to happen. A lot of people presumed it would and had left. Like, there was obviously a lot going on at the time. And my uncle was, you know, in the army. So he wasn't there. So the men weren't there. And it was just my baba, my mom, my two siblings, and my two cousins. And we just trekked through the forest, you know. So I just remember, yeah, just leading. And then you block all of it out, you know, for a long time because it just, yeah, it's painful, right? Like, as a kid, no one should have to get. So you block it out. So the majority of your life, you become this go-getter and you just, it's survive, right? So you get into that survival mode. And when you're in that survival mode for majority of your life, it's very hard to get out of. And then obviously when you have your own children, you're confronted with a lot. And when I went back home, I was 26 and I took my husband back to the village. And I just remember standing there and I was walking the same path I had run through as a child, and everything was just coming back. Everything was, it was like an old movie. So you think part of your conscience doesn't remember and other people tell you you were small, you don't remember, but how can someone not remember that feeling? How can someone not remember those visuals and seeing what they saw? So for a lot of the time, I didn't even trust myself to access that, because I thought that's a Pandora's box, and if I open that, will I ever return back from that? So yeah, that, you know, being 6 years old and feeling nurtured and loved and comforted and having that safety and then having all that ripped away from you at such a young age, you don't have the tools and the capacity to rationalize that. And there isn't enough time to explain. There isn't enough time to articulate. There is not enough resources, time, help. And then it was just like the year from hell. And yeah, and then all the things that transpired after that were just, yeah, no one should ever have to go through that. But that was our normal at that time and our reality. So then it was a while after that until we actually managed to go to the Ica, where my uncle, he lost his legs in the war and he was in like a rehab thing there. So somehow we had gotten to there. And then we had gotten from there, we went out to Germany. So yeah, but I'd say I have to double check with my mum, but I'd say it was probably a year we were there in total during the war, maybe 6 months to a year, maybe give or take less or more. But yeah, so I just remember being told, don't go out, pick potato, don't go get the potatoes with the teta, you know, don't go do, because there's landmines. And I got caught in the fence, you know, where there's tanks. And I remember the UN, and they used to throw chocolate, you know, down at the dirt. And we would all run like animals to get this dirty chocolate, and they'd laugh. And, you know, so Yeah, like just a lot of things, I guess, I wish I could unsee and unfeel, but it's part of your reality. It's part of your story. And then I guess the next 25 years after that are basically just healing and trying to move on from what was.
Going to Rijeka, being the first stop, gave you a little bit of respite, but then you move on to Germany. Now, Tamara, my wife, has not such a harsh story, but she ended up in the 1990s in Canada. And she said to me one of the things that really had an impact on her when she arrived in Canada was, one, that she didn't speak English whatsoever. And it was a massive challenge for her. When you arrived in Germany, not being able to speak German with a culture that is, my goodness, day and night compared with what you'd left behind, how difficult was it for you arriving in a country of safety? What was it really like?
Oh, it was awful. It was honestly awful. I think we were very lucky with my brother, my older brother, because he managed to, you know, we had the Yechnik, like we had this little translation booklet. So if it actually wasn't for him, he translated a lot between us and the soldiers, you know, when we were, you know, in the thick of it in Bosnia at the time. And we would ask for sugar and flour and things like that. And that was the only way we could get by because there was nothing else. And so very grateful to him and obviously then my older sister looking out for me and mum and just the whole thing. And then you think, you know, yeah, safety, okay, security. And you get to Germany and you're in Ausländer, which is like an outlander, which is worse than a foreigner, I guess you could say. And the Germans, yeah, they were not very nice. So you can imagine, you know, being German and then you got all these refugees coming in. So you're seeing it on TV, you're seeing everything transpiring and they're all just coming to your country, to your neighborhood, to your schools and people were not very receptive. It was bad enough that I had a monobrow, I had hairy arms, I had clothes from the Red Cross. Obviously there wasn't uniforms in Germany, so it was just, you know, everybody could wear whatever they wanted in school, which made things even worse because we had the same clothes on every single day for like the whole year. So already the class difference was very, very evident to them. Yeah, we were foreign. To them, we were gypsies, right? So they thought we were Albanian. They thought we were like Turks or, you know, they didn't understand, you know, they were just looking at us like we were just the lowest of low. And it was, yeah, very difficult starting school and not having the financial means to, you know, get new little earrings or to buy a new T-shirt or anything like that. And I just remember one significant moment, I was painting, colouring in this crocodile in year one over there and they said, it's not brown, crocodiles are green. And I just remember all the kids looking at me and like I stuck out like a sore thumb and my cousin was with me. Luckily, I was waiting on her to come as well as come from the war. And it was my mum's sister and luckily she came and we started year one together. But because she was blonde and had very light skin, it was very also different experience for her. She was very quiet. I was very fiery, you know, and I had this short hair because we had head lice. So my mum had to chop off all our hair, bad teeth because of all the malnutrition, you know, from just, you know, not having the right nutrients and things like that. So, you know, physically just sticking out like a sore thumb in classroom with this really strict German teachers and you know, principal, and then the kids just were a reflection of the parents and all and the whole system. And it took as long as we were there, 4.5 years, that's how long it took for them to like us. And for my sister, she was a teenager, so she was in the high school sort of next door to me, and they got bashed. They actually got severely bullied even more. So high school was even worse, obviously, because of the age and all that, whereas I was still, I guess, quite little, so it was a little bit of a different setup. But yeah, being in a classroom with zero German, we could understand some German because of the soldiers. So we did sort of learn a little bit of German. And in Boston, you have a lot of German words being used, you know, like Tankstelle, which is petrol station, you know. So we would say near Benzis Kastanitz, I would say Tankstelle. So we picked up a lot of the German words, but obviously you don't know German. Like you, if anything, you knew a little bit more English than what you knew German. And yeah, it was an awful experience. And it took a really long time to integrate because, you know, with kids, they're ruthless. It's not like when you're an adult, like people put on a mask and behave a certain way. With children, they just give it to you straight. There's no filter. So they just point the big finger at you and tell you you're different and put you down. And yeah, I just went home so many times in tears and look, it was all an experience, right? And it was just the way it was. But we thought, well, this is life here now, so let's make the best of it, you know. And obviously, we were geographically still near family. So a lot of the people that had fled the war were living in around Germany. So we would actually could bike to places. We could catch the train. So we were actually starting to see our family. My grandparents eventually came. So it was in a way this whole, okay, finally we're coming together and we're safe. And then it just, the rug gets ripped under you again.
You're listening to an Englishman in the Balkans.
Welcome to House Victoria, your home away from home in the enchanting region of Banja Luka in northern Bosnia and Herzegovina. At House Victoria, we offer you a truly memorable and authentic experience. Immerse yourself in the local culture, connect with the community, and create lasting memories. Explore historical landmarks, indulge in delicious local cuisine, and venture off the beaten path. We are committed to sustainable tourism and ethical travel. Ready to embark on an unforgettable adventure? Book your stay today. Visit our website at holidayinbosnia.com or reach out to us directly on WhatsApp at 00387-66657916. We can't wait to welcome you to our apartment and share the wonders of this captivating region with you. Let us be your guides as you create memories that will last a lifetime. Choose House Victoria for your next getaway. Your adventure awaits.
When they ripped the rug again from under your feet, why Australia, Ivana? Why did you have to go somewhere else with another language barrier? And not only that, but to travel such a massively long way. I mean, you cannot cycle, take a bus from Europe to Australia. Why Australia, Ivana?
Well, okay, so there was a multitude of reasons. One of them was we actually couldn't stay. So when we got to Germany, we actually went into a refugee center, which was like a big sort of industrial place with bunk beds. We were all sleeping in the same room, communal toilets. It was the first place that I had seen people of color. It was the first place I had seen people of different ethnicities, I guess, other than us, because you've got to remember, I grew up in this little village. So that was like culturally also shocking. We were in this refugee center and my uncle managed to, you know, help us get there. And yeah, it was really sad. There's photos of us holding one little Santa, you know, for Christmas. You know, that was our present, but I was excited. I lined up and, you know, and we were there and we were safe. It didn't matter. And it was interesting how there was so much hatred between what was happening and what was being reported. But then within the refugee center itself, all of us had come together. The Serbs, the Bosnians, the Albanians, the Croatians, everybody was together in one room with the harmonica. There was coffee there, all of us kids kicking a ball. So at that stage, it didn't even matter. It was just, let's find someone that's like us and let's just stick together, right, for survival. We were there for quite some time and my uncle lived in a little one-bedroom apartment and he had a German partner and his stepdaughter. So there's all of us, wild bunch, you know, needing so much TLC, living with him. And, you know, he's the one who got us on track and a lot of the family did. Now, that was our journey in Germany. But then what had happened was they were actually sending, once it was deemed to be safe, our area or where we were from, they were actually saying you can't stay here anymore. So they were actually sending people back. So it wasn't so much choice like, oh, we just feel like going somewhere else. It was a thing of you have to go there or you have to find a different way. But there was nothing to go back to. Like absolutely nothing. So my dad was like, well, I don't want to go to America because I hate the Americans. And, you know, there were some people in Canada, but we didn't have much connections there. So generally you also needed some sort of tie or some connection. And we were lucky enough, we had an aunt living on the Gold Coast and we had my grandfather's brother living in Sydney. So they were bringing in a lot of the family over through paperwork. So basically being like a sponsor, I guess you could say, in saying I'll house them and I'll feed them so they're not a burden on the country. But Australia did have its arms open at that time in accepting refugees, you know. So yeah, my auntie, she sent some paperwork. My dad was doing that paperwork process for 4.5 years. Every time he sent papers, he got a rejection. It was a no. And I just remember him telling me, you know, the last one that he opened, you know, he went to a mailbox in Germany and he said he opened and it said no. like that we weren't accepted again. And he said he just lost it. Like he lost it. He hit his head against the sign. He said people were staring at him like he was crazy. And he said he just fell apart because he just didn't know what to do anymore. At that stage, my little brother was born, which was obviously not planned. So four children to feed. And where are you going to go? So it just was happened by chance that somebody told him, you know, as it is in the Balkan community, somebody tells you something, the Beze, and said, send the paperwork through Bich, which is in Austria, through Vienna. So my dad sent the papers via Vienna, whereas prior him sending it through somewhere else. Somebody worked in an embassy. Somebody had told him something. And luckily enough, my dad was switched on, had quick wits, and he sent it via Vienna. Next thing you know, we get a letter back, pack your bags for Australia. You're doing your physical examinations, you're out in less than 3 months. And literally that was it. So it was just like our parents were telling us, and I said, I'm running away. I'm not going, I'm getting my backpack. I'm running to my grandparents' house. And my mum said, silly, they're going as well. And I thought, okay, they're coming. Okay. So, but we had no, look, we did geography in Germany. We did, you know, European schools are very good at geography. I knew exactly where Australia was, but never did I know anything. We just thought kangaroos and water. Like, do you know what I'm trying to say? We're like coming small town from like central Bosnia. I mean, what do we, you know? And my grandparents, they were supposed to come with us, but unfortunately we went to Frankfurt and we all did our physical examinations and they found out, they called us into a room and they said, your grandfather has cancer. And that was like another blow to us. It was, yeah, just like another thing, right? And we all cried and we were devastated because they were our pillar. In a way, without them, I don't know how we would have survived. And my dad, being the eldest, felt responsible, you know, to his parents and to his family. And yeah, so from what I know now, the information I've been given by family, the only people that managed to stay in Germany from everybody that we knew was my auntie and uncle. And when I had asked her, how did you manage to stay? She said, well, I went to the doctors and I just played on everything, you know, the PTSD card and all of it, which they did have. But she said she was throwing herself on the ground. She was saying if they sent her back, she's going to do all sorts, you know. So they went, okay, well, we don't want to be liable for the, you know, something to happen to go wrong. So she used the system to her advantage and they actually managed to stay there. So they were one of the very few who managed to stay. So I think it was based on every situation, but that's why a lot of the people got sent to America, to Canada and to Australia. So that's how we ended up here.
You mentioned a little earlier about arriving in Germany and there you are. They're looking at you as if you're weird people that don't dress like them and you are very unusual. So what was it like when you actually arrived in Australia? And this is a multi-part question. I know I should ask one at a time, but the Gold Coast where you ended up isn't like anything else in Europe. It's not paved with gold. So you arrive at school or in the community. The Germans, when you were there, are going, what is this? Who are these people? What were the reactions like, though, when you arrived in Australia from the Aussies?
Oh, well, that's interesting because when we got to Germany, it was like, who are we, right? We're these gypsies and we're just these black people coming from. It's as if we were like, you know, aliens to them. And then when we come to Australia, it was, whoa, where have we come to? So the response wasn't so much from other people of, wow, where are you guys from? Because Australia is a multicultural country. They have had, you know, Italians migrating, Maltese, like from the 50s, you know, if not before, obviously from the English and then from the Italians, from the all sorts of different nationalities. There's a strong Asian community within Australia. So it wasn't so much of who were we when we came, like we're all of a sudden interesting. In a way, we were just another blip. But from our perspective, it was where have we come to? We felt like we were on the moon and not in a good way as such. You know, we were like, we got to the airport in jumpers, in like really heavy Adidas, you know, like long pants and you know, on this Qantas flight with no screen, no nothing, no English, no, we had just learned German. It's what's happening. It was just another situation and it was in a way like you just get on with it, you know. And then it's like we get to the airport and it's hot. Like we are sweating. It's probably 85% degrees humidity. It's not as humid now, probably because we've adapted. But it was so goddamn hot, and we got picked up with these cars, and we're sitting in these cars, you know, that are all different. No Mercedes, no this, no, it was all Holden Commodores and totally different cars. It was like, where have we come to this, like, this weird world? And everything looked flat and strange, and it was just strange, David, honestly. And my older brother, poor guy, like, he said to our cousin of a cousin, you know, can you please pull over? I have to vomit. And because it was so hot and there was no air conditioning in the car, because, you know, you've got to go back to like 1998. So it's not like every single car had air conditioning like now. And we were just sweating, and then we were cursing the parents, and we had come to my auntie's house, and we saw a great big cockroach, you know, those nasty things that not even a bomb could blow up. And, you know, we're all running and we're like, cockroach, cockroach. And my auntie says, oh, lo and behold, guys, don't panic. And she gets a spray. And she goes, you just spray it. And my dad's like, cuck up spray. And my dad's trying to hit it with his shoes. So it's like, contrast from even just opening the door was our thing was kill it. And her thing is like, just spray the thing. It will die eventually on its back. And we were like, Isusa, like, where have we come to? And my mum is just doing these ones, you know. And my mum is just praying to God, and she's holding her rosary beads, and we're all just freaking out. Like, this is disgusting, and we hate this place already. So our first initial reaction was we hate Australia. Even though it's got nice beaches, even though there's palm trees, you know, it was a very slow burn. Because at this stage, we're older. At this stage, we've got a little brother. And at this stage, it just feels like we're on our last legs, really. So my parents were 40 when they came here. So, you know, for them, they're like almost getting ready to retire eventually, not have to start a new life. But we were lucky in a sense here where there was a lot more refugee support. So we came on a refugee visa. So there was a lot more support in terms of language and job and medical support and all sorts of things. So they were better equipped, I guess. You know, and obviously it was in their best interest because these people have given back to the community greatly in the last 25 years. And it took us probably about 5 or 6 years to try and get used to it here. Because, yeah, this is the Western world. It's not Europe anymore. I mean, you know, I know Europe's all different, but to me it's not. Now when I come back, it's like it's all beautiful, but it all feels similar and the same, even though there's so many countries in one place, because when you come here, it's just, it's a different level playing field.
Have your relationships now changed from those first formative views and experiences of arriving on the Gold Coast? And now decades on, what has been and how difficult has it been with the relationship between you and Australia, your new home in this massive country in the Southern Hemisphere?
Honestly, it's like a love-hate relationship. It's like a toxic boyfriend at times, you could say. You know, it's like, you know, in one breath, you love it and you're grateful and you're appreciative because this is your safe place. It's what's given you your family. It's what's given you your home. It's what's given you all these opportunities, this safety that you were longing for. But at the same time, this confusion, you know, this gaslighting in a sense of, am I really here? Is this really life? Is this really where I'm going to die one day? Is this really where I'm going to be buried? Like, it just feels strange. I think with Germany, it was a sense of, well, at least we're all together. And at least if I want to see my uncle, we get on a train to Stuttgart, then we go see my uncle. But now all of a sudden there was this huge disconnect. And we're a family of six. And my parents are 40 and no English skills. So how are we realistically gonna, it's bad enough for anybody going to a new country, starting a new life at any age, single or not. It's another thing coming on the back foot of being a refugee and needing all this extra help and all these resources. And it's like, how does one go about making it, I guess you could say. So our parents did sacrifice a lot on their end so that we would get all the opportunities that they didn't, you know, whether it was through schooling, education, or just anything in general. But often now, I just cried the other day, and I said it in my last podcast with, you know, Cody, Chasing a Croatian Girl author. And I cried the other day in the car. We're in the mountains, had this beautiful drive, went to visit some alpacas. My son's in the back. My husband's next to me. Life's great. We're not struggling. And I just cried. And he said, what's wrong? And I said, I miss home. And he's like, oh, you know, so that's that hard part of You fully integrated. You talk like them. You don't stick out like a sore thumb, but you feel different. You feel different, and the mentality with inside of you is different, because you've got to remember, first 7 years is your foundation. It's your building blocks. And that's what makes you, you know, into the adult you are today. So yeah, I have a bit of it's a tug of war, I guess you could say, within me. The goal would be to be 6 months here, 6 months overseas. That is everybody's goal, is what we just talked about before. But yeah, it's still not full acceptance, I would say. And I don't think, as a foreigner in a country that's not your own where you were born, I don't think I'll ever feel full acceptance. Only because I came here so much later in the 90s than what other people did. Because there's a gradient of foreigners here. So you've got my in-laws who came, their family came, migrated from Italy in the 1950s and the 1960s. So you got to think their generational wealth and the multi-generational that they're building, it's like they were able to leave so much behind for their kids, which is very different to the way we came in. So you've got those foreigners, and then you've got us. And I feel like it's two different stories. You can't say it's the same thing. So often people confuse being a migrant, being an immigrant, and being a refugee all in the one. And it's hard to explain to people. Because we didn't come by choice, we were forced out of where we were. Whereas their families came by choice. Of course, they were forced to a degree, yes. Also, I'm not saying they weren't. They had to go where life seemed better, where there seemed to be more money, more food, more security, more safety. Everybody's forced to a degree, right? But in our situation, it was truly forced. Like, would we have ever left if that didn't occur? I highly doubt it. We would probably be like, there's people in the blue zones, you know, the Netflix series, like the people in the Greek village and the people in the Japanese village that stay there for 90 years. You know, that probably would have been us. So sometimes I do wonder who would have been that Ivana, you know, if we did stay. Only a handful of people stayed in the village, chose to stay. And everybody, yeah. My grandfather didn't want to go. I know my dad wouldn't have if it wasn't for us. So yeah, you feel also great responsibility wearing that, I guess, to a degree where you feel like you have to be excellent and you have to really be passionate and you have to make something of yourself, because it was on the backbone of all everyone who came before you.
When I first moved into this rural community where I live now, people couldn't get it. And it was very difficult for me as well, because I like things like mint jelly on my lamb. That is just not on here. I like to drink when I can get it, Guinness. But black beer has only, as far as I'm aware, only come to this country in the last 15 years or so. And I like Marmite, which is a definite British thing. I know you have Vegemite down under, but something else that people couldn't get their head around. And I was coping with my cultural differences. How difficult was it? How confusing was it maybe for you to cope with the cultural differences of being somebody from Bosnia-Herzegovina to that of what you were surrounded by in your new home of Australia?
Oh, really, really, really bloody hard. You know, the integration, when I was living at home, first of all, let me circle back to the whole Vegemite story. If anybody hasn't, whoever's listening from wherever they're listening from, Vegemite is disgusting. And Brits have their own version, okay? It's something you have to grow up with. It is absolutely an acquired taste. And when I had first come to Australia, months with the cockroach situation, there was also the Vegemite situation. So Vegemite is very well known to Australia. And my cousin says to me, even I come to the kitchen, first of all, everything looks strange, feels strange. I feel strange. She gives me this big spoon and she says, it's like Nutella. So I think Nutella. Hello. Like, I grew up, I spent 4.5 years in Germany. I love anything Ferrero, you know? So she says, Ivana, it's like Nutella. And I'm like, she's my cousin. She wouldn't betray me. Also, the Aussie banter and the slang and the comedy that Australians have is very different to the Balkans, right? So they're trying to joke with me, but I'm taking an offense. So I'm thinking, my cousin wouldn't screw me over. Like, I know they're funny, but they wouldn't give me something I would gag over. And they give me this spoonful and I just put it in my mouth and I just like bloody spat everywhere. And I went, this is so disgusting. And my mum comes running over, Stai Vilo, Cherry, you know what's going on? Everybody's freaking out. I'm making a drama. I'm crying. You know, it's truly, really not that much of a deal. But at that time, he's just like, I'm trying to get used to things. Why are you torturing me? I already feel tortured enough already, you know? So that was the food experience. Now, in terms of the heart of trying to keep the culture alive, it was a lot easier when we lived with our parents. Because our parents, you know, it was slightly suffocating, to be honest. I did run away from home when I was 16. I struggled really badly. So I came, I was around 11. School was tricky. I mean, in Germany, I was failing school because of the language, because of everything. So I was almost had to repeat year four. I come to Australia and I'm top of class, top of the class. First of all, they're using calculators here. And in Germany, we weren't allowed to use calculators. It's all maths. So all of a sudden, I go from being the lowest in the school to being the highest. And I thought, what the hell is going on? There was no English support for me. I was in the primary school, which is Osnabrückschule. So there was no English support for me. I was in a very heavily dominated Aussie school. So I had a volunteer mum teaching me how to read and how to learn English. And she was awful. God bless her soul. So I took it upon myself to learn it on my own. So that's where I am. Like, my dad basically was like, Ivana, sink or swim. You can't. We were sick constantly. We were constantly sick, trying to get used to the food. Like I said, a lot of Asian influence here. So we were learning Japanese in school, which was just so strange for us. You know, we're thinking, aren't we learning English? So while we lived with mum and dad, it was, yeah, easier to keep the culture, easier to keep those things, but it felt suffocating. Because in one breath, they're telling us you have to adapt. But then in another breath, my dad says, in my house, under this roof, is my rules, is our language and our culture and our things. And out there is this other thing. So it's like in one breath, it's that you can't talk English in here. You can't, you know, it's just our language, our things, that's it. So we were felt like we had to coexist. We were one way in the home, and then outside the home, we had to be Aussie or try and be Aussie. So that's where the language came in, where I thought, if I become really good at the language, then I'll just be like a chameleon and nobody will know I'm different. So that's where that eternal thing was coming in to fit in rather than to embrace standing out. But when you're a child, standing out is a painful thing. So what you want to do is integrate as heavily, but you'll lose yourself in that integration process. And then eventually you become a parent. Eventually, you know, you become this role model to other people and you go, it's not really about integration anymore. Now it's actually about stripping back the layers, stripping back all the conditioning and going back to the original me. So yeah, it was tricky. When we had all moved home, like out of home, which dad never wanted us to, my dad said to my mom, you know, don't get your license. And she said, why not? And he said, because Ivana's here, you know, and our younger son's still living here. She said, but she's not going to be here forever. So he was shocked when I moved out before marriage. So I broke a lot of rules. I was a big rebel in the family, I guess you could say, a rebel, which I really embrace now. It served me well. But yeah, then when I left home and moved out with my boyfriend, which is now my husband, it was a big no-no. Dad wasn't impressed. Yeah, it was much harder to keep the tradition and the culture alive because all of a sudden I have my husband, I have the Italian layer, which I'm also trying to respect and learn a lot more about. And then I also have me and then also have the element of I live in Australia. So to put in perspective, it's not like Starbucks, you know, where American stuff is infused everywhere. Here, there is none of that. It's one Croatian club and we would go to the Croatian club and then they would look at us like we weren't Croatian. Because to them, Croatians who related to themselves as Catholics, Croats, you know, they come from Bosnia, so you're Bosnian. So there was all that. There was all those layers. It's like, well, where do I go then? If I go to the Bosnian club, I'm not accepted there either because I'm not Muslim, right? So you go, where am I? Where do I belong? I don't even belong in my niche. And then you just slowly start to step away from all of that and you think, you know what? If I miss a song, I'll play it. If I want the food, I'll cook it. You know, if I want to learn something, ask mom and dad. I'm building a family tree. Talk to my parents, talk to my aunts, talk to my uncles. So that's where you start to co-create in a way that feels right to you. And yeah, it's a lot harder to keep it alive. It really is, especially when you have children, because where's the resources? You know, there is no school. There is no school where I can put him in for 2 hours on a Saturday that will teach him. I have to teach him. So there's a lot of pressure. And then again, it's like my little cousin learned Croatian. He taught Croatian for the first 5 years of his life. He went to kindergarten and he couldn't talk English. And, you know, people frowned upon that as well. Like, wow, your kid lives here, but he doesn't talk English. So it's actually frowned upon to infuse your culture, if that makes sense, because it's almost like you're making your children to be at a disadvantage, which I've had to fight that notion as well, unfortunately.
Veliki pozdrav svima, ko god da nas sluša bilo gdje u svijetu. Volim vas sve, šaljem mnogo ljubavi, poljubaca i pozdrava. Pratite Ultra magazin ultra.ba ili ga potražite na TikToku, Instagramu ili Facebooku. Ja sam tu također za sve vas. Možemo se družiti, možemo sarađivati. Potražite me na Instagramu, Dijana Tepšić.
You're listening to an Englishman in the Balkans.
Yeah, being a chameleon is very difficult. So I have this pretty harsh question, actually, for you. Out of your three-point chameleonism, if there is such a word, what is strongest for you? Is it the Australian side of life? Do you lean more to the Italian part of your life now through your husband? Or is it where you've come from? I know it's a difficult question, but maybe?
No, no, no. It's actually really easy. It's where I've come from, 110%, all day, every day. I just had a conversation with my husband this morning and I said, I know my niche now. And he looks at me and he's like, what do you mean? Because we, you know, your business, you talk about, you know, having your niche, who's in your niche. And I just remember I was meant to be working with the lady who's in my neighborhood and she wanted to work with me. And it wasn't a problem and I was happy to do so. And I thought, God, I hope she doesn't book me. And I thought, oh my God, am I turning down money? You know, for someone who wants to, this is my area of brilliance. Like I'm a people genius. I love connecting with people. I love bringing their story to life. And I just had this twist in my thinking where I thought, actually, I don't know. Every time I light up, it's where I'm connecting with my people. When I say my people, I mean Serbs, Bosnians, Macedonians, like all over, okay? All over the Balkans, you know, and that's why when I was creating Balkan Six, I thought, God, what do I call it? Slavic Six, Balkan Six, Croatian Six. I want to include everyone, but I'll always exclude someone. It's just the way it goes, right? But I just feel this innate sense now that I'm getting older, like my heritage is important to me. And especially since my grandparents died, I crave it even more. Because I think when the grandparents die, it's like pillars. And when those pillars come down, who holds it together anymore? Why, you know, do you have to talk to that cousin anymore? Do you have to be friendly with that aunt, you know, who's rude to you? Like, do you have to do these things? You don't. So then comes a question of, well, what are you going to do with that sense of feeling? What are you going to do with that sense of family, sense of community? So hence why I started the podcast, hence why I'm talking to you. And these people just keep coming into my life. I never go look for it. I wasn't purposely looking for a different podcast or a different project or anything, but it just came to me. It was like this magnet. It's like just automatically what I'm attracting. And I noticed the difference even with my neighbors because they would come to my house and it's a full feast. It's a full barbecue, full fridge, full drinks. You know, and they come over with their drinks already. You know, BYO, bring your own. And I just think that's such a funny concept. That's actually offensive that you're bringing things into my house. What's even more offensive is you're not bringing anything for me. Because, you know, in our culture, the first time you go to someone's house, you bring something. It's just a gesture, you know, it's an etiquette. But they're coming into my house with their own drinks that they're all drinking, but they've brought nothing for us. So A, they think we don't have anything. And B, oh, we just didn't want to be an inconvenience. And I'm like, sure, but you ate everything off your plate and you went back for seconds and thirds. So in those moments, I'm like, this is not my people, right? And I've met lots of beautiful Australian people and Filipino and Japanese that I love. But generally, the people I connect with are always foreigners. And then in specific, they're from the Balkans. Even if I hear they're Ukrainian, even if I hear they're from anywhere other than Australia and maybe within that similar area of ours, I just gravitate. You know, it's like, for me, that's such a simple answer. And I think the older you get, the more you crave home. And the more you crave those comforts. So hence, why I'm talking to you and why I'm trying to, I guess, refine the community even more and better than what I had before in the past. Because in the past, I just thought, oh, well, you know, what do I do? What's little old me going to do? You know, what powers do I have? Nothing. You know, I'm just this little old refugee and like little kid. And you know, whatever, like I'm not welcome here, I'm not welcome there, that's fine, I won't go anywhere, you know. And then I thought, you know what, stop being fed up with yourself, you know, stop feeling sorry for yourself, like that's lame, like go out and create something and do something about it. So yeah, hence why we're talking today.
When I started this podcast all those years ago, I wanted to break down the misconceptions and stereotypes that people make and have about this very misunderstood heart-shaped country in the Western Balkans. And I find it very difficult to change people's points of view and sometimes to open their eyes to what this area and this country in particular is all about. How difficult is it for you to do that down under in Australia? Do people ask questions? Are they interested? And yeah, what misconceptions and stereotypes do they have? Is it hard for you?
Actually, what's been my experience, I don't know if it's been different elsewhere, like I do live on the Gold Coast. It is a very tourism driven town. It is very sunny. Like, so the state I live in is Queensland, which is called the Sunny State. So everybody comes here to holiday. Whereas my other family that lives in Sydney, which is New South Wales, and also other states like Victoria, which harbour cities like Melbourne, the communities are much larger on a bigger scale. So to put in perspective, in Sydney, where my family lives, there's a whole suburb that's filled. Literally every second car has some sort of religious ornament hanging off the car. Whereas here where I am, nobody, I'm the odd one out, right? Like I have my Baba gifted me the cross. They just put it on there and that's it, right? It's from her. So it's a contrast even within Australia, because you have a country within a country, if that makes sense. So it depends where you are within Australia and within that cultural context. Now, where we are, there hasn't been any of that. People don't have any connotation. Most people, so when we came, we would go and order food and people would hear us talking, right? And they don't know Srpski, Hrvatski. They don't know any of that. And they would say, like, I'm talking to a Japanese person and I'm ordering Japanese food. And they would say, what language are you guys talking? And me and my mum look at each other. We're like, let's just say Croatian, okay? For context sake, to keep it easy on them. They say, oh, Croatia, where is that? Like, so this is about 20 years ago. So to them, like Croatia, you know, we're like, no, we're not anywhere near Asia. Like how could they understand? They were foreigners themselves. So you're standing there and you met with this lovely person who wants to learn more about it. She says, write down where you're from. I'll Google it. I said, oh God, I'll save yourself the headache. Please don't. You'll never get out of the maze. But then when you go to Sydney, where my great auntie lives, they actually have a club called Bosna, which is for the Croats from Bosna because of the different music they listen to. And then they also have two Croatian clubs. So there's so many different layers upon layers there. So there actually isn't this, maybe over there, there's more of a negative connotation and being from where we're from. But here, they don't even have any sense of who we are because we're sort of just these chameleons. When I went to a Croatian Women in Network, it was this leadership event and they asked me to speak. And I went there and, you know, I spoke and told my story and, you know, what I do and all that. And some of the ladies are like, where are you from? I said, from the Gold Coast. They said, we're from the Gold Coast too. And I said, have you ever been to the Croatian club? They said, no. Because we've been here for like 40 years, 50 years. We never thought to go because we don't know the language. We don't know if we would be accepted there. We don't know anything. You know, we don't know anybody. So, of course, why are you going to go to a place where no one knows you? You're going to go where it's familiar. So you've got all of those layers too. And I opened up the speech and I said, yes, I come from a part of, you know, back then it was former Republic of Yugoslavia, which nobody even wants to admit really anymore. It's controversial even to say that. And, you know, and then I said, but now it's considered, you know, Bosna. And, you know, this is the town and the place. And I said, but I'm not, you know, Bosnian enough for the Bosnians. I'm not Croatian enough for the Croatians. So I just run my own bloody race, you know, and everyone had a laugh. Because everyone can relate to that. It's like, well, you're not Bosnian enough for the Bosnians because you're actually a Brit, but you're no longer really British either, are you? Because you've almost changed yourselves in a way by infusing yourself in this new culture. So when you go back home, you probably feel like a bit of a foreigner to them as well. So yeah, I haven't had that trouble or that issue of most people when we came didn't know where we were from. They didn't even know there was a war. Now that's just in this town. I can't speak for other bigger cities where there's bigger communities. Now, that's changed since Croatia entered the EU, and now there's quite a lot of tourism. So when you say just Croatia, just to keep it easy for them, and Croatian, just so that there's no confusion, like they don't even know the history. So, you know, you're not going to enter this whole discussion of like, you know, how we are, Chiasi or Daklasi, Štaradiš, whatever. You know, people are here more general chit chat, more surface level, you know. And you're ordering your coffee, just say, yeah, Croatian language, you know, and then they say, oh, Dubrovnik, and you're like, nowhere near there, buddy. Like, go up a few miles, go and like trek over this mountain and, you know, then get on your push bike and then a donkey and then you'll eventually get to where I'm from. But so, you know, they just now relate Croatia with the coast. They don't actually know there's so actually even more to Croatia than what there is, which is just, you know, summer and holidays and yeah, Dubrovnik and cruises. But for most of the foreigners and the Aussies, it's just the coast for them. You know, they don't even bother going across the ditch. Like, don't even bother heading into, you know, Montenegro or anywhere else where it's beautiful. Because once again, tourism is very low. They haven't marketed that. There's no funds, you know. I mean, yeah, it's still in those rebuilding phases, like what you said before.
What a great phrase. Jump the ditch. And I would say that if there's anybody listening, not only from Australia, but from around the world, jump the ditch, come to this part of Southern Europe. If you want to go to Croatia and be with the other tourists, do. But you really want to come to Bosnia and Herzegovina. After all, it's got more waterfalls, for example, than all the other European countries put together. So if you're into chasing waterfalls, this is a place to come because this country's got everything.
But not just waterfalls, David, not just waterfalls, honestly. It's when I was going across the Kupnes and I was leaving Knin, you know, I went to visit some uncles and I was going from Knin and I got picked up in this orange old wagon, like this combi. It was like a Borat style, okay? That's probably the best way to describe it. And the man who was picking me up happened to be a distant cousin. And he says to me, cousin, you're sitting at the front. And there I am in my white sneakers, my beautiful watch, you know, glowing and shining all the way from Australia. And he says to me, you're sitting at the front. And I'm like, oh, my God, there's curtains inside the van. There's a little bubba with like a little handkerchief. Yeah. I'm like, I'm going to die. This is, I sent my husband a text and I said, if you don't hear from me from the next 3 days, I've probably dropped off somewhere, you know. And funnily enough, we went over the Kupnes and I see the horse sign, you know, and I'm just thinking, what are these horses? What's happening? And then I just see these herds of horses and I just think, wow, it is so untouched and so raw and so beautiful. And that's just one area of so many. And yeah, even when I was picking strawberries with my granddad or picking potatoes from the land, I felt sad when I was there. I felt sad when I was in Bosnia because it was in a way like it wasn't doing itself justice, if that makes sense. You know, I saw the feast and I saw the shopping center and then I saw the expensive shopping center, which I went to out of curiosity. And I saw they were selling the same pair of Nikes that I was wearing. And actually, it was an older style. And they were charging 250 maraka, like 250 or whatever how many dollars there is. And when I lifted up the sole, they actually weren't even genuine. They weren't even genuine Nikes. I knew there were ripoffs. And I just thought, is this really what's happening here? Like these poor people, like $250, you know, or maraka. I was just in shock. And even the main shopping center in Vitez, where I was visiting my grandfather, they had eBay junk. It was the whole shopping center was filled with eBay junk. I saw a skirt. It was $50. And I thought, 50 maraka for somebody who earns $3 an hour is disgraceful. Absolutely. And, you know, and then the amount of kladionices that exist there, which is the bedding stations. You know, so they're just tapping into people's sadness even more. They're tapping into people's despair even more, into the trauma, into the everything, you know. And I just think, come on, we can do better than that, you know. But then when I saw the stray animals, I mean, that was a whole other layer. Then I was fighting with my cousin's husband at the time. You know, he's saying, people don't even have anything to eat. Screw the animals. You know, what are we meant to do about them? They were getting angry at me that I was rescuing the animals, that I was feeding them, that I was wanting to build a shelter or help. Or I so badly wanted to, when I got out of there, I felt so heavy. And then when I went back, my husband left home early and I was at my auntie's house in Zenica and my mom said, what's wrong? like I was in the car and she says, "Shut, dear, what's wrong with you?" You know, and I just said, "Mum, every time I look out the window, I just want to cry." You know, because you're seeing bullet holes, you're seeing just things that could have been, should have been. They took me to Vlasic, you know, the mountain up there where they had, like, I think the Olympics a very long time ago. I saw a bear in a cage and that was an amusement for them. And my auntie says, "Oh, do you like it? Have fun. And, you know, do you want a photo?" And I'm like, guys, this is inhumane. You know, I come from a place where if you lose your bird, people print a poster, Tweety's missing. It's even on a tree, you know? And I just started to get depressed while I was there, really. And I thought, if that's how I feel after being here for a month, imagine how everybody else feels. And they were so immune to it. Like my little cousin, he ate something and then he threw the rubbish down into the grass and he just threw it in his own backyard. And I said, "What are you doing? Clever kid, knows three languages, knows more about Australia than me." And I said to him, "What are you doing?" And he said, "But what's your smeche, you know?" And I said, "There's a fucking rubbish bin for that, you know?" And he sort of looked at me and I said, "Come on, you can do better than that. You're smarter. You're a grade A student and you're throwing rubbish in the environment." Like, so he ran down and of course he got it and he grabbed it and he put it in the bin. I said, and I hope when I saw the rubbish in the rivers and the water streams, I was just, yeah. I mean, they were shocked by me and I was shocked by them. You know, it was a complete cultural, it was so strange. It was not what I had remembered. It was not what I had pictured. It was not what I had anticipated. It wasn't that I romanticized it. I'm very realistic. But at the same time, I thought, isn't that common logic? Like, you have rubbish, you just throw it in the bin. But then you have to consider, I didn't stay. We forced out, right? So how can I place judgment upon these people and their knowing or lack of knowing? I'm coming in now as a foreigner almost, as a Westerner, like, hey, what's going on? That's wrong. And, you know, how dare I? You know, they didn't like that. They didn't like that I had an opinion. They didn't like that I was vocal. And also to them, I was too smiley and too positive and all of that. So I felt I just felt it was best to sit and not say anything over coffee, waited for my plane ticket, and I arrived back, quote unquote, home, and I was just shouting from the rooftops, "Thank God." And my husband said, "God, you are a strange girl, because one minute you're saying you hate me, you go over there, you don't belong there either, and you're happy to come home." And I said, "Well, maybe that's just my destiny and I'm okay with that." So in a way, it did bring me a little bit of peace, you know, because it was always a question of, could I integrate back there? Would I move back there? But obviously, if I was to do it, it would all look very different. You know, being an adult now, being 35, being a parent versus being 26 and, yeah, going home the first time.
As we cruise now towards the end of this episode, you have your own successful podcast. It's called Balkan Sis. Ivana, what made you want to have a podcast and what keeps that motivation going? And you talked about your niche, which I think is a word that is sometimes overused. Tell us about Balkan Sis, please.
Well, Balkan Sis originally started with my best friend and I. So my best friend, I have to shout her out here. Her name is Franca. She lives in Zagreb, but she was actually my first friend in Australia. Our stars sort of, I guess, aligned when I was hating school, hating my life, very unwell, very sick. Didn't have the ESL, the English support within that schooling system. That my brother and sister had. And all of a sudden, the universe or God or whatever you want to call it, drops me, this Croatian girl from Zagreb, in my classroom right next to me. And obviously, we become best friends. Hello. So the poor girl, even if she didn't want to be my friend, there was absolutely no other way that she would ever not be my friend. We were like, tied at the hip. We were like sisters and we really helped each other. Her stepfather was working in the UN at the time after the war. So hence why he's an Australian and her mother married an Australian. So he was her stepdad. So there was her connection between Australia and Croatia. So that's how she came about being here. We were best friends. Eventually he went back to help repair everything, you know, from the war. He got called back over and they had to go back to Croatia and she was devastated. This is pre-emailing days even, I guess you could say, dial-up internet, like not even a dial-up internet. So we lost touch for many years, and luckily she found me again. We wrote letters to each other, but eventually we moved as well. And luckily when Facebook popped up, I hadn't changed my last name yet. She reached out to me and she said, "Are you this Ivana?" And she sent the school photo and I said, "That's me." And off began our relationship again, and we got in touch and whatnot. Our love ship romance continued for many, many years. She actually came back to Australia and lived with us, and she's now the cool mother to my child and all of that. And she actually chose, just before COVID had hit, she was waiting out her citizenship here. And she decided to just bite the bullet and go back to Croatia because her husband is there. And then COVID hit and everything went down south after that. Now, we knew for a long time we weren't going to be reunited because of what was happening. So we used to have these great conversations, as you know, when you talk to anybody who's from there, you talk for hours. So we would have these phone conversations and we would talk and talk and talk. And I said to her, "Why don't we turn this into a podcast? Why don't we actually, just because you're there and I'm here doesn't mean we can't co-create, because we had a business here together and we loved working together." So I said to her, "Why don't we create something for people like us? You know, how many of, you know, of us is there around the world who are probably thinking, I'm alone, I'm different. Yeah, where's my voice? You know, where's my sister or my person?" Even though we had each other, we thought, well, not everybody has that friend. So she said, "Yeah, let's start a podcast together." So that's how Balkan Sis was born. And it was COVID, it was lockdown. So we thought, why not? Get some headphones, get a microphone, Google, YouTube, you know, what program? You know, we're resourceful people. If there's a will, there's a way. And we started out recording. And then it progressively became more and more difficult because, you know, they were coming out of the COVID lockdowns quicker than what we were. And she has a business that she runs. So often the recording times wouldn't match up. I had a small child who was keeping me up at night still. And it just became so hard. And we said to each other, "Look, let's not put pressure on. This was born from love. Let's not now make it this thing." And we said, "All right." And she said, "You keep on running with it. Don't kill it off and just continue with it." So that's what I did. So I changed the introduction, I changed the music, and yeah, like shuffled around the episode and started again. And yeah, it's been a slow burn because I'm wanting to do it in a way where it's from the heart and it's honest and it's authentic. And it's like you plant a lemon tree, you're not going to get lemons tomorrow. So it started out from love and I wanted to continue on that path. It is difficult with guests because they are all on a different timeline. So, you know, there's people in Florida who are going to come on. I've got people who listen in Dubai, for example. So I've got so many different time zones and you're having to match them and their lives and you and your life. And then, as you know, David, there's a lot of prep work. There's a lot of organizational work as well. Like, you've got to research your guest as well as to who's coming on. And yeah, so there's a lot of stuff around it, but I'm enjoying it because it's bringing me these type of connections.
So what is a dream then for Ivana? And we'll start and do it bit by bit. So what is Ivana's dream for the Balkan Sis podcast?
Well, the dream for the podcast, you know, I, like I said, originally just started out as a project for me and my best friend. That's all it was. It was, "Hey, let's record our conversations. Let's have fun. If, you know, one person listens to it, great. If 1,000, great." Never really thought beyond that. Then when I started getting people contact me through that, and saying, "Wow, I really loved the last episode," or "Thank you for making me feel seen," or "Thank you for this," or reaching out. And I had people reaching out from all over, from the smallest corners of the world. I thought, oh my God, like, it never dawned on me before that I could actually, you know, turn this into something. But because we have our physical businesses here, it was only ever a passion project. But now, as I'm going further and further along with it, and my son is getting a little bit older and he's starting school next year, I think I'll dedicate a bit more time to it. So at this point, I'm still following the breadcrumbs. There's no immediate big plans. But I've got some exciting guests and it makes me think there is a space for it, you know? So yeah, I was shocked when I found out your podcast, how long you've had it for. Like almost, what, 10 years or something like that? I just was, yeah, blown away. Like, wow, to do that and to be that diligent and that consistent for almost a decade, like, that's unreal. So, yeah, now that, like I said, my family's, my little son's getting a bit older, I think I'll dedicate a bit more time to it because I like the community, I like the connections, I like the conversations. So, yeah, maybe take it from a hobbyist sort of, you know, passion project into something else, but we'll see. It's still yet to reveal itself.
And finally, you mentioned something, or you said something a little bit earlier on, and it was about arriving back in Australia, having come here, seeing the sadness of it all, like the bear in the cage, which, by the way, they'll always have a bear in that cage. If it dies, then they find another one to put in it. The Livno horses, the second largest herd of wild horses outside Mongolia, and if I can use that as Europe, and of course, people throwing garbage down. But what is Ivana's future in Australia? What is Ivana's future? Is it to stay in Australia and come back to your country of birth? Or is there something saying, yes, the half and half, the 6 months here and the 6 months there, is that something? Or is something saying to you from here, come back?
I know David has a holiday home, from what I found out, or a little Airbnb or something like that. So that does sound tempting, actually. Like, there's like three answers to this. So one is, you know, yes, the people and what you were saying with all the moving parts in Bosnia, they do so well for themselves when they come here, you know, and they're forced to survive and they're forced to make a way, and it's quite incredible what they can do. And then you go back there and you go, wow. But then again, how can I comment on that? I didn't have to live that reality of staying there and having to, you know, heal there. So it's often, yeah, it was fueled with anger and what the hell, and also at the same time, really big empathy, because these are my people. How could I, place that judgment upon them? I also hate that it's being picked apart by foreigners to a degree. I feel like the foreigners is actually what's going to save it, unfortunately, because at this stage, the people living there haven't been given the resources or maybe the time or the money to make it what it needs to be. When I see the mountain plains, you know, when I see all these people coming from different parts of the world, you know, buying off the shopping centers and the land, and you know, even when I went to the convenience store, I was wanted to buy something for the kids, and my cousin said, don't go to the big chain, I'm a good Kineza. And I said, Kinez in the middle of Bosnia, what the hell? And I went to the Chinese grocer, you know, and we bought like stuff for the kids. And there's this lady who's Chinese talking to me, na bosansky, you know, she's like, tri marke 50 feninga. And I'm like, I'm in shock. And she said, yeah, they own a whole neighborhood. And I've just thought, how, why, what? Like, I was so perplexed, but what else is there supposed to happen? What is the right way? I don't know. Like, I don't live there, so I can't make too many comments, but it's partial sadness, but also partial, well, is this what it's going to take, right? Foreigners coming in with money and creating something out of it. Now, with the whole coming back and staying, that's also yet to reveal itself. In my postpartum days when I had my little baby, all I watched was House Hunters International on repeat. Every day at the same time. This is what happens when you have a little baby. I'm sitting in the air conditioning and it's really hot and I'm feeding this baby and I'm watching House Hunters International. And that was my mental escape of, wow, I could do this. And then every day would just be on repeat. So me and my husband would talk about it a lot, quite a lot, because a lot of people from here have gone during COVID. Prior to COVID, during, and more so after, a lot of people have migrated back, but that's because they have the funds and the opportunities to do so, possibly even because of the remote opportunities that exist now that didn't exist before. Also because being on the Croatian, you know, you've got the nomad visa. I'm not sure too much on Bosnian visas. And if I can pull both passports, it depends, because I want the Italian one. I can't hold too many, or the Aussie one. It's always a conversation in our house. It's always something that we're chugging over, that we're dissecting, that we're talking over. So I wouldn't say a complete no or a complete yes. I think we're just trying to get our businesses to a point where they're fully remote. So, you know, where we have the income, we can rent out our house so that we have the security if we ever choose to come back. And then essentially we go over there, because yes, it's a beautiful dream, but you know, you go back and then what? What do you do, right? If you haven't got something set up, you haven't got a visa, you haven't, you know, I'm not prepared to go work at Konzum and be a checkout chick, you know, and start back from basics. So that's where you do have to have that secure income. You are changing your child's life as well. I would, for the cultural immersion, purely for VTOL, because I do feel like for children, this is a huge positive But then at the same time, I gravitate towards Nome and the safety of being here because we didn't have safety. So I'm very compelled to give my child something I didn't have. So I'm split between the two. And like the podcast, it's still yet to be revealed. I'm sort of not trying to force life how I did before. That got me into a lot of painful situations forcing things. So I'm now trying to take a bit of a more Laganini approach, like my dad says, and just live and enjoy. And I'm also a big believer in it's good where you make it. So you can be in the most beautiful country, have all the amenities, but you don't enjoy it. So I'm also very conscious of it's not better somewhere else because you think it is. Make it great where it is, where you are at the moment. And you're living proof of that as well in Bosnia. You know, you're dealing with the challenges and the ups and downs, but you also trying to make the most of it and the best of it. So that's the space I'm playing in at the moment. But this is feeding my soul. Like talking to you, it's like I'm in Bosnia right now, but I'm not, but I'm getting that sense of connection. So I think home is also, yes, it's a geographical location, but it's also the people that can feel like home too.
Ivana, as we wrap this up, here's your 60 seconds of selfless, shameless self-promotion. I'm going to put all your links, don't worry, in the show notes and description, wherever people get to either see or hear this podcast. So where can people find you on the dreaded Instagram, Facebook, X, formerly known as Twitter? Where are you to be found on the interwebs?
I'm pretty much everywhere. In Australia, in Bosnia, everywhere, but also on the interwebs. Obviously, you can email me, ivana.alfonso@hotmail.com. But the email function is also available if you go to my Instagram, which is @ivana.alfonso. And you can connect with me on there via email. I'm on the Twitter. I'm not that active on there, but mainly Facebook, Instagram. I started a little YouTube channel. I'm still yet to, you know, progress that into something. But yeah, email, online, anywhere, really. I'm pretty interactive online. You have to be when you have a business. You can't afford not to. And yeah, so just reach out. Obviously, I do one-on-one mentoring, one-on-one coaching, so all things marketing, sales. You know, it's life coaching along with business coaching because the two are interlaced. Often people will get me for one thing and then they actually realize it's about something else. Specifically now I work with a lot of Balkan people and that's been really satisfying because I share that common connection and I know their hardships. I can relate to their stories as well. So I guess that gives me a bit more of an advantage than maybe if they got somebody else. But we have a product-based business as well, me and my husband. And that's not anything relevant to the Balkans, but that's really cool that we do that together. And yeah, so just send me a message, even if it's not about business or anything like that. You just want to say hi and you just want to connect. And obviously, Balkan Sis, my podcast is everywhere. So Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcasts from, that's where it is. And I swear a lot there, probably more than what I should. I was conscious not to swear too much today, dropping the F-bombs because I can get quite passionate. But it depends who I'm talking to. You know, it depends. So once again, the chameleon comes out.
I'm going to finish off with doing something that most people who run podcasts don't do. And that's to say, thank you very much indeed. And there's just a little to and fro between the host and the guest. But I want to do something different. And you said the secret to success is authenticity. And so I hope I'm being authentic at the moment with my one last question. And it is this: a lot of stuff going on in the world now, and it has been for some time, and I don't think it's going to change much in the future. But as a former refugee, Ivana, what advice would you give to people living where they grew up and they're ending up somewhere they never, ever dreamt of, and they've had to move involuntarily? So they didn't make the decision. It wasn't their choice, but they've been forced out and they're going to end up leaving where they felt coziest and going somewhere else. So what advice would you give to those people who are trying to start a new life in a foreign country?
Honestly, it saddens me so much that this just keeps happening. And you think like the buck will stop with you. You think, yep, that was it. No more after that. And then it just continues and continues and continues. And you think, okay, this is the world. This is, I can't control the world. We can't. What makes me any different? What makes somebody else? It could happen even here. When I saw the way the Aussies were responding during COVID, I mean, I wasn't in shock, actually, because it takes a lot to shock me and my family. But there's so many layers to this question and this answer. And I read already through in Palestine is, 1 million people displaced. And it's a hard pill to swallow because you just think, why? Why? It all happened. And you just think, why? So that I could say I'm this and you're that. So that I could have, my own flag or my own, I don't know. I might offend some people with that because it's highly important to them. But to me, I'm not about that. And for anybody who's been displaced, or by choice or by willingness, I think you've just got to buckle up. Like, there's no right way. It's just like parenting, there's a million right ways to do things, but yet there's no manual, there's no script, there's no nothing. But finding support services is really important. Because I think what tends to happen is you have that foreigner mentality of just get on with it. And that was very much us, is just get on with it. There's no time to talk. There's no time to complain because you are in that survival mode. So I think trying to find resources or connecting with people who could give you resources is really, really important because you can't do it on your own. It leaves lasting impression that it's for the rest of your life, right? It's for the rest of your life. There's so many small ways that things come out where it's not a normal reaction to something. Something will happen and I'll respond. And I think, God, that's not how most people respond. But yet I have. So it's this constant learning and unlearning of how to be in the world because it's this pecking order of where do I belong? And I would just say, continue to carry on your traditions. Continue to listen to your music. Continue to be vibrant, to be who you are. Don't worry so much about fitting in. Yes, it's necessary to fit in because it's what's required for you to assimilate, make a life for yourself. But at the same time, if being close to your community makes you happy, do that. But then again, some people just don't want to be any more part of the community because it looks different on the outside. The community on the inside and on the outside looks different. So for some people, it's about stepping away from the community. So I would just say doing whatever makes you feel happy and doing whatever feels most authentic to you. There is no right way. That's probably the best way to articulate it. There is no right way. Just the way that suits you and your family and getting resources and getting help and forging some sort of little community is really, really important. And continue speaking your language and continue giving that to your children because as much as you think I want them to assimilate to this new culture, it's also important to retain what you have because what you have, it's been passed down for you and it should be treasured, But once again, when you're in survival mode, nothing else matters. Like you said, with the rubbish, we had bigger things to, and now that's become the mentality. We have bigger things to worry about. It's not so much about the rubbish, but you think, oh God, start with the rubbish. Let's start with that, So yeah, there is no right way. Get help, get resources, continue to share your story. That's been the biggest thing because in my family, there wasn't really a big dialogue. We never really talked much as a family, unfortunately. We're very close, but it was such a painful past and such a painful part of our lives that, through telling the story and through being open and honest, it's made life a lot easier because then other people reach out and you realize you're not alone, right? Same as you. You're not the only foreigner in Bosnia, and then you connect with other foreigners and you go, wow, I'm not the only one, right? So when you split that burden, it's a lot easier to carry.
And that's a wrap for this podcast. We hope you've enjoyed finding out a little more about both Bosnia and Herzegovina and the wider Western Balkans. If you've enjoyed this journey as much as we enjoy bringing it to you, please take a moment to leave us a review and subscribe to our podcast. Your feedback helps us tremendously and makes a huge difference. Thank you once again for joining us, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe giving us a tip or becoming a member of our podcast family. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for listening. We really do appreciate it.